This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union. We are part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on Sunday evenings at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast. You simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone or tablet and search for DC 37 State of the Union. You can also stay in touch with us. You can check out the website, www.dc37.net. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you have any comments about our show or would like us to promote a community event, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. That's stateoftheunion, one word, at dc37.net. We're going to begin tonight's show by welcoming Richard Rothstein, who is a fellow at the Economic Policy Institute and a senior fellow emeritus at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund's Thurgood Marshall Institute. He joins us by phone from the West Coast to discuss with us his book, The Color of Law: A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much.
Now, this is this book, as I understand it, sort of breaks up the myth that America's cities came to be racially divided through what's called de facto segregation, like individual prejudices, income differences, or the actions of private institutions like banks and real estate agencies. You're arguing that the laws and policy decisions passed by local, state, and federal governments actually promoted the discriminatory patterns that continue to this day. Yes?
Yes, you've got it exactly right, except I would say that they did more than promote. They created it, they sustained, they reinforced it. Without government action, our residential neighborhoods would not be segregated today to nearly the extent that they are, if much at all. The segregation of the country residentially done by government is as unconstitutional a system as the segregation of water fountains and buses and lunch counters and all the things we dealt with in the 20th century. But we've never addressed it, and we should.
Well, how, first of all, this was done just because, and this goes back to the 1920s, or this goes before that? I saw something.
Well, mostly it was the 1930s. It was the New Deal. It was the Roosevelt administration, because the federal government wasn't much involved in housing before the New Deal. There were state and local policies before that that promoted segregation, but the big push was the federal government. The biggest policy that the federal government pursued was the suburbanization of the country. It was a plan by the federal government to move the white working class out of urban areas into suburbs. It was a racially explicit plan. In New York, you're familiar with Levittown, which is east of New York City, 17,000 homes in one place. The federal government financed that in the sense of underwriting the bank loans that Levitt took out in order to build that subdivision, that suburb. The federal government required that no homes be sold to African Americans as a condition of its bank loan. It even required that Levitt place a clause in the deed of every home prohibiting resale to African Americans or rental to African Americans. This was a racially explicit policy pursued by the federal government, and it wasn't just Levittown. It was in every metropolitan area in the country where the federal government created suburbs in the 1940s and 50s.
And at that time, was there any attempt, or was it just, this is the way it is, the way that Jim Crow existed in the South, these are the policies of the U.S. government, or this is what the U.S. government supports?
Well, there was certainly opposition. It's not as though nobody knew about this. It's not as though it was a secret. The subtitle of my book is A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. It was not a hidden history. There was a committee in Levittown of homeowners called the Committee Against Segregation in Levittown in the early 1950s. So there was protest of these were liberal whites. The NAACP was on top of it and protesting it constantly. There were members of the Roosevelt administration who were opposed to the policies of segregation that the administration was following. Perhaps the most prominent of them was the president's own wife, Eleanor Roosevelt. So there was not—it's not that there wasn't opposition, but this was the theme of the Democratic Party, North and South. It's not the case that this was only done to pacify Southern Democrats. This was a an institution that was promoted by Northern Democrats as well.
And did this exclusively exclude African Americans?
Well, by the mid-1940s, late 1940s and 1950s, African Americans were the primary target. Earlier on, there were exclusionary clauses for Jews and other minorities, but that became much less important, much less widely enforced as time went on.
And as you,
Jews were able to move into Levittown, for example, without difficulty.
And as you say, there was an explosion of movement from the cities to the suburbs, the creation of suburbs, which were now housing millions of people across America. And that was, and blacks were left out of that.
Yes, and there was an explicit policy of the federal government, a design of the federal government to move the white working class out of urban areas into suburbs. And we created a white noose around every metropolitan area in the country with that federal policy.
But folks, I've heard folks say, well, you know, that's why we passed the Fair Housing Act of 1968. And 1968 is a long time ago. So isn't this may be a sad chapter of our history, but isn't it over?
Well, that's a terrific question. The Fair Housing Act is not capable of remedying the segregation that we created. The Fair Housing Act can, if well enforced, and it's not even well enforced, can prohibit ongoing discrimination. But the effect of the policies that the government followed in the mid-20th century was so powerful that they exist today. I'll use the same example, Levittown, although you could do it with any metropolitan area in the country, any suburb. Those homes that were sold in the mid-20th century to returning war veterans, primarily World War II veterans, sold at the time for, you know, in today's currency, inflation adjusted, about $100,000 apiece. They now sell for $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. The Fair Housing Act says, in effect, okay, African Americans, you now can buy into the suburb, but these suburbs are not affordable today to working class families of either race.
And
the white families who bought those homes, gained over the next few generations equity, wealth from the appreciation of the value of their homes. They used it to take care of medical emergencies, perhaps, or temporary unemployment. They used it to finance their retirements. They used it to bequeath wealth to their children, who then had down payments for their own homes. That wealth is one of the major contributors to the ongoing racial inequality that we have today. On average, African Americans in this country have incomes of about 60% of white incomes. African American wealth is only 10% of white wealth, and that enormous disparity, which underlies so much of our racial inequality between a 60% income ratio and a 10% wealth ratio, is entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy that's never been remedied. So the Fair Housing Act has succeeded in permitting a few wealthier African Americans to move into Levittown, but it's still much, much, much wider than its surrounding community. And as I say, that's never been remedied.
Richard Rothstein is Distinguished Fellow of the Economic Policy Institute and a Senior Fellow Emeritus at the Thurgood Marshall Institute of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. We are talking about his book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. What are we supposed to do about this? Because it's an interesting, as you were talking about the fact that blacks were deprived of building wealth because they did not have access to homes that increased in value, that sounds to me like a good case for reparations.
Well, reparations is a small part of what needs to be done. We need something much broader. We need policies to redress segregation. Reparations to most people means a single payment, monetary payment to the current generation. That's not going to solve this problem. The payment could never be great enough to compensate for 400 years of slavery and Jim Crow. Some of the policies that we need to follow will cost money. For example, if we subsidize African Americans to move into neighborhoods that are now exclusive for whites, that would be a costly program, and we should do it. But there are many things that we should be doing that don't cost a thing. For example, we should be prohibiting zoning ordinances in those all-white suburbs. that prohibit the construction of anything but single-family homes today on large lot sizes, so that townhouses and apartments for moderate-income families can't be built. We have federal programs today that perpetuate, that reinforce segregation, even though they no longer say that the purpose is to create segregation. The biggest federal program that we have to subsidize housing for low-income families, not moderate-income, but low-income families, which is disproportionately used by minorities, is the low-income housing tax credit. It's a tax credit for developers to build low-income housing, and most of the housing that's built under that program is built in already low-income segregated neighborhoods because it's easier to build there, and it reinforces segregation. So there are many, many policies that we should be following to redress segregation. There's no lack of knowledge about what those policies are. What's missing is a new civil rights movement that's going to demand it.
Well, finally, given the political tenure of the time, how optimistic are you that these changes can be addressed?
Well, I'm very optimistic because when you say the political tenure of the times, I'm sure you're talking about the rise of white supremacy and its enabling by the President of the United States. But on the other side, there is also a more accurate and passionate discussion about the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow than we've ever before had in American history. We have the Black Lives Matter movement. We have white elected Southern politicians running around the South removing statues that commemorate the defenders of slavery.
We have a black mayor of Montgomery, Alabama, don't we?
Yes, as of today, yes, that's very exciting. We also have, it's not just the stunning reception of my book. There are books like Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow. There's Brian Stevenson's Just Mercy. There's the tremendous reception that Ta-Nehisi Coates' work has gotten. So I am optimistic. We have these two contending, very polarized forces in this country today, but we shouldn't ignore the positive forces. And there's at least a chance that the positive forces will overwhelm the negative ones. Not a guarantee, but a chance.
I knew this time was going to go by too quickly. Richard Rothstein, I really appreciate the time that you spent. The book is called The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. Required reading in the times in which we live. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano, and joining us now by phone is the DC 37 Political Action Director, Jeremy John. Sir, welcome back to the show.
How are you, Chris?
I'm good. Trying to get through the miserable weather of fall.
It came back with a vengeance, didn't it?
It sure did. We're talking, among other things, about a new program that DC 37 has begun, a program to encourage and train members to run for political office. And this is something that we're in the throes of right now, right? This month is October, and you are conducting training sessions. How did this all come about, and what are we talking about?
So first of all, the The program is called the Emerging Leaders Canada Academy. One of the things that we've encountered over the last 18 months or so is obviously off of the 2018 election and off of the 2016 election, where many people will say this country has taken a turn for the worse. We saw a lot more increased activism amongst our membership, and a lot of our members wanted to engage in a different way within the political process. A lot of them have been volunteering through our political program, but now folks wanted to take a different step, a different tact, and change government for themselves. So myself, the executive director, local presidents, they started receiving inquiries from members about them wanting to run for office. So what we decided to do was create this program which trains our members on how to run for office. One of the things that, you know, in my previous experience, particularly for first-time candidates, they don't know what's involved in a campaign. Some of them decide to be the campaign manager and the candidate at the same time, which is, you know, a big no-no. That's one of the worst things that you can do.
Why is that? Why is it a no-no to run your own campaign?
The sheer burden of a candidate on raising funds, on door knocking, on being outside at rallies or events, so on and so forth.
Right. Selling yourself.
You remove yourself from the decision-making of what needs to happen what needs to happen on a daily basis, minute by minute, hour by hour, hour by hour within the campaign itself. So you eliminate a key decision maker when you're out knocking doors, when you're out making phone calls, when you're out doing all these activities. There's no one running the shop. So that's basically one of the bigger reasons why you don't do that. And you don't provide yourself with a buttress against making bad decisions. Oftentimes, that's what a campaign manager does. A candidate gets a wild idea. The campaign manager is there to say, let's take a step back, look at this from different perspectives, then make a clear decision.
And the worst candidates probably don't listen to their campaign manager.
That is also very true.
What's the Yogi Berra line? I coached great, but boy, did they play rotten. Now, let's take a step back. According to the AFL-CIO, nearly 750 union members won public office nationwide in the November 2018 elections. Now, that is, I mean, I interpret that as a reaction to, well, two things. I interpret that as a reaction to the world in which we live these days and wanting to get involved. But also, these are not novice folks. These are folks who have been involved in some way, shape, or form in their communities, correct?
That is absolutely true. Like, these folks are either members of the community board. They're members of a civic association, whether it be an issue advocacy group, or you know, it could be as localized as a block association. These folks are actively involved in their community. They're actively involved in the direction that their community goes in on the most basic and some would say the most important level. And you know, they want to take that additional step now, where you know sometimes you often don't feel comfortable just standing on the sidelines when decisions are being made. And these folks are actually picking up the baton and say, listen, I want to be at the table. I want to be a part of the conversation. I want to be a part of decision-making in the direction of my community.
And as you say, AFSCME, our national union, has done programs like this across the country. When you put this out there for the first time, did you have any sort of preconceived notions about what the response was going to be, and what has been the response been like?
So when I first put this out, I thought I would get a small cohort, maybe 40 or 50 people would express interest, just because our members, their lives are filled with
They're busy.
Responsibilities.
They're busy.
Right? They're busy. From the moment they wake up until the moment they put their head down on that pillow, there's always something happening in their lives, right? That's just the nature of who we are as New Yorkers. But once we started promoting this, like, we got over close to like 150 people who called, expressed interest. They want to do this. They were excited that we're doing this, which the response really, really took me by surprise. Quite honestly, I did not know that there was that level of a desire for folks to be elected officials within our universe. So it was very exciting to see and feel that.
And you have had one of these sessions. Now, just so people are clear, this program, the three sessions, has been signed up for. A session has already begun. You have to commit to attending the three sessions,
all three
sessions. What was your sense of the first session in terms of the kinds of folks who are stepping up and saying, yeah, I want to do this? And what are they looking for from us in terms of?
So the first day was kind of a foundation day. We talked a little bit about labor history. We talked about the State of the Union, like you mentioned, some of the direction that and the impact that labor elected officials, members, elected officials from labor have had on us since 2018. We spoke about that. We gave them a viewpoint of what their voice means and the perspective that it brings to the elected class and how important it is. And I think that was something that was refreshing and also very, comforting for them, that their voice won't get lost out there in what can for many be called the ether of political discourse. So they were very, very comforting. They were very, very comforted to hear that. I mean, one of the things that we also did was we brought in a special speaker, Councilmember Alika MP Samuels, who you know is a former DC 37 member.
Yes, she is.
She spoke about her journey to being an elected official. She spoke about her, her earlier roadblocks, why she ran, some of the sacrifices that she had to make to run, and on her pathway to victory, and like that experience that she provided was very critical for folks. Like she received a lot of questions around her decision making process, what type of sacrifices that she had to make, obviously. You know, the role her family played in it, so on and so forth. So, like, that real-world experience was very important for them as well.
And I guess there's one big question that's out there. In a world where everyone tells you that there's way too much money in politics, how can someone feasibly run for office without deep pockets in 2019?
Well, it's a good thing to live in New York City, right? One of the great things that we've done over the years is we've created a very strong public financing system that makes the low dollar and the community dollar more impactful than you would the big checkbook writers. So right now, last year, the city passed a 8-to-1 match. So every dollar that someone gets from a community member, to get $8, the city will match it by $8. So that kind of...
That's a big deal.
Yeah, that levels the playing field a lot, right? So now it's up to the hardworking candidates, the quality candidates, to go out there and get their message out and connect to the voters in a real way. Because, you know, now the system is going to be flush with money in a different way than it has in the past.
We're talking with Jeremy John. He's the director of the Political Action Department at DC 37. Let's shift gears a little bit. Issues that are out there. We've got about 3 minutes left. Let's talk about the importance of the census. I think that the folks know that the census is out there. They understand a little bit about what it is. But tell us about what's at stake for New York in the next census.
As you know, our executive director, Manny Guido, serves on the state's Census Commission, and this not by accident. We understand how important the census is to our communities, how important it is to our jobs. Look, the census, the census...
And let's be clear. The census is getting an accurate count of the number of people who live in the city of New York, the state of New York, right?
Correct. That is the goal of the census. Based on that count, we apportion the number of representatives that we have in Congress. We apportion the number of support in terms of revenue that the federal government sends to the state and to the city. Important things such as funding for NYCHA is imperative, funding for our schools through Title I money. Like those things are all tied to our census count. And the unfortunate thing right now is we've lost, over the last two census, we've lost at least three congressional seats. With this current census, there is a chance that we can lose up to four seats.
We being New York State, lost three congressional seats in the 2010 census. Is that right?
No, we lost two in 2010, and we lost one in 2000.
Wow, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So
at stake in 2020 is
potentially four.
Wow.
Potentially four, and that's by the early estimates that the commission has come up with. I mean, a lot of this is unfortunately tied to the conversation that has happened around the immigration question on the census form. Which will not and is not on the form. And I encourage any listener, all of our listeners out there, to encourage our friends in the immigrant community to fill out the census forms, because the money that goes to support services for immigrant services is also tied and tied to the census.
And this you're referring to this environment of fear that now exists, unfortunately, because of the Trump administration. The point is to encourage folks to step up and be counted, to not have that fear, because the census is not about anything other than getting that count. This is not
absolutely
right.
Absolutely.
This is not information that's shared with ICE or anything else. This is the number of people who are in the city, and if we're not, especially if immigrants are unwilling to be counted, then, as you say, a lot is at stake in terms of the representation.
Absolutely.
And we've got an election in November. That's about the city charter, correct?
Yes. And this November, there are two things that are going to be on the ballot. Public advocate Jumaane Williams will be on the ballot. He has a race this year, and then you have the charter question, which will be on the back of the ballot. And, you know, in certain localized communities in Staten Island, I know there's a judicial race in Queens. There's a the borough president's race. Excuse me, not the borough president, the district attorney's race. So in some localized communities, that there will be some additional races on the ballot. But for the most part, throughout the city, it's going to be the public advocate's race on the front. And on the back, there will be the Charter Revision Commission has five questions that will be on the back of the ballot.
And we will keep people apprised of that as we get closer to it. Jeremy, thanks very much for being with us today. I'm just about running out of time, brother. So it's always a pleasure to have you with us.
Always a pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
That's what we've got for you tonight. I want to thank our guests, Richard Rothstein of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund's Thurgood Marshall Institute, and Jeremy John, director of our Political Action Department. Remember, if you have any comments about today's show or about any of our shows, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. We appreciate your feedback. Rudy Orozco is the producer. The sound engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I'm Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.